Ferris B'nai Torah presents The Schmoozed, an engaging and motivating Mussar and Hashkafa series that deals with real-life issues.
There's a famous Yalkut Shimoni that if you've learned in a Mussar yeshiva, you've heard, and if you've been exposed to basic Mussar concepts, you'll be familiar with the Yalkut. But I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn by carefully reading and carefully understanding what this Yalkut Shimoni is telling us. It says the Yalkut Shimoni as follows. Limdecha Torah derech eretz. The Torah is teaching us derech eretz. I would assume this means sort of wisdom and understanding. Kesha adam ose mitzvah. When a man does a mitzvah, ye oso so believe shalem. When a man does a mitzvah, he should do it with a total dedication, with total devotion. V'sameach, and he should be happy. Where do we see this? Says the Yalkut as follows. She'ilu haya Ruvein yodea makasu alav. Had Ruvein known what would be written on him, shenema v'yishma Ruvein v'yatzelim yodam. Had Ruvein known that the Torah was going to write about him, that he saved Yosef, that he was the one who saved him, hayatono lalichol etzel aviv aktefo, he would have picked him up, taken Yosef on his shoulders, and walked him back to his father's house. Had he known, it would have been written on him, about him as follows. Ilu haya Aaron yodea, had Aaron known, shakarish baruch hu kosev alav, had Aaron known that when he was going to greet Moshe Rabbeinu, when Moshe Rabbeinu was first coming back to Mitzrayim, and Aaron greeted him, had Aaron known that Hashem was going to write about him these words, that he saw Moshe Rabbeinu was happy, then he would have greeted him with tambourines, with flutes, with a whole marching band. So the Yalkut is telling us that had these individuals, had Ruvein known, had Aaron known, they would have reacted differently, they would have acted in a different way. And says the Yalkut in conclusion, the Sha'avar Hayod Mosa Mitzvah, originally a man used to do a mitzvah of a Nevi'im Kosen Alav. The Nevi'im used to write on him what he would do. Akshav Shein Nevi'im, now there are no Nevi'im, Mikosev Osa, who writes it, Eliyahu Melech HaMashiach. Eliyahu writes it together with Melech HaMashiach, V'Kadosh Baruch Hu Chosim Al Yodeim, and then Hashem signs it. So this is the Yalkut, in very simple terms as follows. Ruvain did some good in attempting to save Yosef, but had he been more motivated, had he been more driven, he would have literally saved Yosef. Yosef would not have been sold to Mitzrayim, Yosef would not have been in that pit. Had Ruvain known that they were going to write about him, that he was the one who saved Yosef, he would have grabbed Yosef on his shoulders and walked him back to Yaakov Avinu. So too, Aaron, had Aaron known that the Pasuk was going to say that he was happy, he meets his brother and he's filled with joy, he would have met Moshe Rabbeinu with tambourines, with flutes. Therefore, the Yalkut concludes that when you do a mitzvah, you should do it b'lev shalem, with a total dedication, you should be happy, because you see the difference that a little bit extra push, a little bit extra drive does, so you should do it in the same way. And the problem with this Yalkut is that each of the stories seems to contradict the very point that the Yalkut tells us. And I'll explain to you what I mean. There was much reason for the brothers to assume that Yosef was attempting to kill them. The Sfurno tells us that the Shiftei Ka were tzaddikim gemurim. That means Ruvain, Shimon, Levi, every one of the brothers were absolutely pure tzaddikim. Yosef was chosen by Yaakov to be the leader, and he did certain things that were considered foolish. And when he would report what the brothers did back to his father, the brothers took it as a sign that Yosef was out to get them. When Yosef had the dreams and he reported it to his brothers, the brothers took it as a further proof, and their assumption was that Yosef was out to get them to be cursed by Yaakov. He wanted to be the sole leader, the sole progenitor of the Klal Yisrael, and he was attempting to get Yaakov angry at the rest of the brothers. Now this was not unfounded, and Yosef exposed an awful lot of room for them to make such an error. And Chazal tells us that the brothers sat down as a Beis Din, Dan the Shaila, and Paskin Yosef Lemisa. It was not done flippantly, it wasn't done just without forethought. Very careful deliberations, the evidence was weighed, and the decision was reached that Yosef is a moreid. He's a rebellious individual, either trying to usurp power from Yehuda, or trying to destroy all of the brothers, and he's chayev misa. Now, obviously, Reuven reached a conclusion against the brothers from the fact that the pasuk tells us that he was trying to save Yosef. And in fact, the Rishonim tell us that that, in fact, was his intention to save Yosef. It's obvious that Reuven concluded that Yosef was innocent. So if Reuven knew that Yosef was innocent, what he understood to be happening was cold-blooded murder. Meaning, if Yosef is innocent and the brothers are out to kill him, they are going to be guilty of a horrific crime. Killing one of the Shiftei Ka, killing Yosef HaTzadik, a crime of unimaginable proportions. So obviously Reuven was very, very motivated to stop this heinous crime. He understood the gravity of the situation. He understood it was a Ritzicha situation. He went out to save his brother. However, he made a very careful decision. You can't ask for too much. Tafasta meru below tafasta. In fact, the Ramban explains at first he tried a little bit more. He tried to get the brothers to totally renege. He saw he didn't get anywhere. So his mid-ground was, put him in the bar. And as the Pasuk says, he was intending to save Yosef. He was going to come back later when the brothers weren't there, and he was going to rescue Yosef. But the point was that he was very cheshbened out, very carefully deliberated what his plan was, and he assumed that if he asks for too much, it'll backfire. Hatzala purta, let me get a little hatzala, let me get him out of the immediate danger, put him in the pit, and then I'll save him. So what does the Yalkut mean, that had he known that they're going to write about him, that he saved Yosef, then he would have marched Yosef out on his shoulders, as if to say he didn't understand the gravity of the situation, as if to say if he had more motivation, he would have done something differently, when he was clearly very, very motivated, made a cheshbon that this is the appropriate thing to do. So I don't understand what the Yalkut means, that had he had more leiv shalem, had he had more simcha, he would have done something different. It doesn't seem to fit well with the Yalkut itself. And I don't believe that the example that they bring from Aaron is any easier. Keep in mind, my friends, that the probably one of the most difficult nisyonos that a human being will ever face is in a sign of kavod. Now, I'll grant you that in our society, there's so little kavod given to anyone that we may not ever have the type of nisayon that these individuals faced. But Aaron HaKohen was given a huge, huge test. For 60 years, he was the Navi Hashem. For 60 years, he was the Manhig of the Klal Yisrael. For 60 years, Hashem said to Aaron, and Aaron relayed that message to the Bnei Yisrael. In a flash, his position was usurped. Instead of he being the Navi, there was a new kid on the block. And it wasn't just that he was being eliminated in the sense that he wasn't going to have his position. His younger brother was going to be the Melech. His younger brother was going to be the Sar HaTorah. His younger brother was going to be the one to bring the Torah down to the Klal Yisrael, the greatest kavod that any human being could ever experience. And clearly, this was a major nisayon. To understand how big the nisayon is, just look at Moshe Rabbeinu's response. When Hashem comes to Moshe Rabbeinu in the snare and says, you will be the one to bring the Klal Yisrael out of Mitzrayim, Moshe Rabbeinu says, count me out. For 6 days straight, Hashem is mefata. Hashem attempts to seduce Moshe Rabbeinu to accept. For 6 days straight, Moshe Rabbeinu refuses. And Rashi explains to us the pivotal point was one thing. I will not accept this position. My older brother was the Navi. I will not take away his kavod. I'm not going to hurt him. And Hashem spent 6 days trying to convince Moshe of one fact, that Aaron HaKohen will not bear bad feelings. Aaron HaKohen will not feel badly. And in fact, finally Hashem, Kaviyochel, gets angry with Moshe and says, "V'racha v'samach b'libo, you'll see. When you'll meet Aaron HaKohen, when you'll meet him for the first time, he will not feel badly. He'll see you and he'll feel joy. He'll feel happy. And kahava, when they meet at the first moment, Aaron has joy, happiness in his heart." Yet this Yalkut is telling us that had Aaron HaKohen known that they were going to say about him that he met his brother with joy, he would have gone out with tupim, umacholos, with flutes, with tambourines. This Yalkut is very difficult to understand. He won the battle. Aaron did it. He won the ultimate championship. He proved himself to be a tzaddik of such purity that there was no jealousy, there was no kinna, there was no any of the normal drives for honor wasn't there. He met his brother with joy in his heart. And to such an extent, the Chazal tell us that because of this, he was zochet to the Choshe Mishpat. He, as a Kohen, wore the Choshe Mishpat on his heart because such a pure heart deserves to wear the Choshe Mishpat. So he won the war. He was the ultimate champion, the real Gibor. He won the ultimate test. And the Yalkut is telling us that had he known they were going to write about him, then he would have gone out with tupim and mechalos, with tambourines and flutes. So the first question is, he was quite happy. And to the extent that he actually was zochet to the Choshe Mishpat for it. And if you'll tell me, oh yeah, he was very, very happy, but there's nacha madrega, it could have been a little bit happier. He could have had another little bit of happiness. I would say to you, therefore what? If the man conquered his nature, if the man met his brother in the Midbar with joy in his heart, and he felt great happiness, so he could have had a little bit more happiness. Therefore what? That difference makes a difference. So I believe that this Yalkut is doubly difficult. Number one, Reuven was motivated to save his brother. Had he known that they were going to say about him that he saved his brother, it's hard to see what he would do differently because he planned it out. And number two, Aaron was very happy. Had he known that they were going to say about him that he saved his brother, maybe he would have had more joy, I don't know, but that little bit of extra joy doesn't seem to make much of a difference. So I'd like to see if we could get a better understanding about what this Yalkut is telling us and understand what's happening here. And to do this, I'd like to share with you an observation. We now enjoy a lifestyle that is vastly different than the way people lived 1,000 years ago and even 500 years ago. You go back some 5-6 centuries in time, you'd see that the average person was living in a bare, austere existence. Dirt floors, cracked walls, tiny little huddles, you can't even call them real houses because they were made of just sort of some boards nailed together. They would chop wood in the morning, put it in the stove, subsistence farming. The average person was dirt poor. All of the conveniences that we have were non-existent. Our life right now is radically different in almost every imaginable way. The comforts, the luxuries, the pleasures, the food, the cars, the technology was unheard of. And there were certain pivotal points in history that really made the change. One of those pivotal points was the Industrial Revolution. Up until that point, the average person was involved, engaged in private enterprise. If I was a tailor, I sewed together suits. If you were looking for a suit, you came to my house, I measured you, and made for you a suit. If I was a farmer, I wasn't a commercial farmer. I grew vegetables, I grew corn, or whatever I grew for my own subsistence. And basically, the human race lived hand to mouth, barely eking out a living, barely producing things, and the average person was dirt poor. The major breakthrough of the Industrial Revolution was intense production, producing mass goods, creating factories, creating systems so that one person can produce a huge amount of stuff. And if one person can't do it, a few people help him, 5 people, 10 people, you started factories, started production systems, and the amount of output that the human race began putting there was phenomenally increased. Goods were available, people could now buy clothing, food was available, the concept of housing, the world changed. However, the Industrial Revolution began long before there was power to power it. You see, the Industrial Revolution began in the, I would say the 1600s, certainly the 1700s when it really took hold. But electricity was not of any use until centuries later. So you had people who were organizing factories. They had the concept of producing mass goods and the need to move it across the country. But the basic source of energy, the basic power to the machinery, wasn't there. One of the pivotal points in history It was in 1769 when James Watt invented the steam engine. Now, the steam engine was a tremendous revolution because by harnessing the power of steam, there was now a force. There was now an energy source that could power machines. You can now take a locomotive and send it miles per hour, 30, 40, maybe even 50 miles an hour, running down a steam track, running down an iron track, because the steam was the engine, the steam was the energy, the steam was the power to it. And I'd like to share with you one interesting observation about this. What is steam? Steam basically is very little. I guess it's vaporized. It's water that vaporizes. It's kind of water molecules in a different form. It's a gas, but it's basically nothing. However, steam has a great power because it expands and it forces, and it's such a force that it can move a locomotive. But steam only becomes steam at 212 degrees when water hits the boiling point. If you bring water to 211 degrees and keep it there all day under normal atmospheric conditions, it will not boil. It'll be hot, maybe even very hot, but if it doesn't hit the boiling point, it'll never create steam, it'll never get there. One little extra degree. The difference between 211 and 212 is the difference between water boiling and giving off this energy, this power, steam, which can move a locomotive or something that's very hot. But if you think about it, that is a profound observation because 211 degrees is very, very hot. 212 degrees is not much hotter. In fact, it's so little of a difference that it's not even a percent. The difference between 212 and 211 is less than half a percent difference. Yet that difference is so profound that it's a difference between water boiling and not, between there being steam and there not being steam. And that, I believe, is a tremendous muscle for a certain state of human excitement, human empowerment. There is a certain state where a human being reaches that 212 degrees, where he hits the boiling point. Oftentimes, it's a very subtle difference. The difference between 211 and 212 often is but a very, very subtle point. But when he hits that 212, he's on fire, and at 211, he's very hot, but he ain't quite there. And this difference, I believe, will show itself in many, many situations. If you study the Olympics, you know that many meets, many events are won by hair breadths of time. In the 2004 Summer Olympics, in the men's freestyle swimming, the 200 meter, the difference was great. It was 1.42 seconds was the victory. In the women's event, it was half of a second. In the men's 800 meter running, it was 0.71 of a second, meaning a fraction of a second was the difference between gold and not. And what you find in the world of competitive sports is that oftentimes tiny little slivers, fractions, make the difference between victory and failure, between success and not. And I'd like to share with you one point that I find very, very profound. We, in our community, we don't follow this particular sport. And you probably wonder when you look at the Kellogg's box what they're doing on there. But in the world at large, the concept of the Daytona 500 and the Indianapolis 500 is a big, big deal. Now, the Daytona 500 and the Indianapolis 500 both are races that are run over 500 miles. The track, there are about 200 laps of this track, 500 miles. The race takes over 3 hours. Would you like to know, over the past 10 years, these are the prime racers, these are professionals, the winner takes the prize of over $1 million. This is the prime race, two of the prime races in the country. Over the past 10 years, the average victory has been based on the difference of 1.5 seconds. That means the difference between victory and not is 1.5 seconds, but it's a 500-mile race, and it's 200 laps, 3 hours, and they're so matched, they're so pitted for victory And the victory over the past 10 years has been based on 1.5 seconds. However, I saw a clip of the Daytona 500 from 2007. And I watched the final lap, and I watched them pass the checkered flag, and for the life of me, I could not tell who won. And I heard the announcer say the words, and won, yes, he won, he won. How do you tell? But when you stop the video, when you stop the clip, you can see that the car behind is a hairbreadth, literally a hairbreadth ahead at the finish line. The finish in the Daytona 500 in 2007, the victory was won by two one-hundredths of a second. 2/100ths of a second, and the stop, you could see it. The car was, in fact, a hairbreadth ahead, and that's an astounding concept because oftentimes the difference between total success and total failure is a minute little bit, a very small amount. And when you understand that, you understand that oftentimes little differences make a tremendous difference. If you'd like to understand the difference in Reuven, I think the answer to the Yalka really is quite simple. And that is, Reuven was very motivated to save his brother. He understood that this was murder. And he understood that he was the only one who recognized it as such. And he understood that it was his mission to save Yosef. And he was pretty motivated. Maybe 211 degrees motivated. But he wasn't quite at the boiling point. Had he had just one more little push, had he known that they were going to write about him for Dore Doris, for generations, they were going to write the words, Reuven saved Yosef, that would have been the extra push. He would have hit the boiling point, and with that new resolve, with that new energy, he would have had a different perspective. With that new energy, that new perspective, he would have realized that he could do it. He has the power, he could say the words, I'm taking this boy back to his father. He could have affected the Shvatim, they would not have stopped him, because with that resolve, with that energy, he could have taken Yosef on his shoulders and walked him to his father. The reason he couldn't was he didn't quite hit the boiling point. When he was at 211, when he understood the danger to Yosef, when he understood the gravity of the situation, he was almost there. But with that resolve of almost being there, of 211, he could not have saved Yosef. The brothers would have stopped him. There would have been a rebellion, maybe even a civil war, but he would not have accomplished it. But had he been 212, had he hit the boiling point, had he really understood they were going to say about him that he saved Yosef, that resolve would have been different. That resolve would have given him the strength, the energy. He could have saved Yosef. And I believe what the Yalkut is telling us is that 211 and 212 is not a subtle difference. The difference between hitting the boiling point and almost hitting the boiling point is huge. And oftentimes in life, the difference shows itself between success and failure. And I believe from this part of the Yalka, there's a tremendous lesson to learn. I've said this before, but I'd like to repeat it. If you're looking for a business to go into, I have a good eitzah. I recommend highly that you go into selling used exercise equipment. And I'll tell you why I think it's a good business. Anybody who puts on a few pounds at some point says to himself, this is ridiculous, I can't fit into clothes anymore, I feel sluggish, that's it, I'm going out. And he buys himself an elliptical machine, buys himself a fancy treadmill, spends $500,000, $700,000, and within about 3 weeks, that treadmill becomes a very fancy clothes hanger, and he's not using it. And the reason for that is because he began his program with a tremendous desire. I want to lose weight, I want to get in shape. And he begins this new program with a desire, and he may even take it to the next stage. He may even reach a level of commitment. I am committed to doing this. I'm going to get on that treadmill every day. I'm going to run, I'm going to exercise, I'm going to get in shape. And when you have desire and you have commitment, you go out and you buy yourself your treadmill, your elliptical machine, you invest the money, you begin the program, you begin doing what you should do. But then something happens about week 3, week 4, week 6, or week 8. And that is, the desire sort of wanes a little bit. That commitment sort of relaxes a little bit. And before you know it, your treadmill is acting as your coat hanger. And that's when, if you're in business selling used equipment, you look up the ad on luach.com, you look up the ad in the newspaper, you pick up that $1,000 treadmill for $200 and go sell to somebody else who now has a new desire for $800, and you got yourself a nice little business, used exercise equipment. My friends, here's the very key observation. Desire is a big deal. Desire is what gets you out of bed and says, I'm going to do something about it. Commitment is the next stage when you say, I'm committed to doing it. But desire and commitment will fail time after time after time because desire and commitment tends to lessen. There's a third element to any successful thing, and that's something called persistency. You have to be persistent. You have to have desire, you have to have commitment, and you got to have the wherewithal, the fortitude to push and keep on pushing even when you don't have as much desire, even when you're not as excited, even when you're like a little tired. But that persistency is the difference between success and failure. But that persistency only happens to a person when they reach a certain level. You see, if you go into the program at 211, very hot, very, very hot, your desire, your commitment will take you so far. You have to get to the boiling point. You have to be at 212, and you have to hold that temperature. You have to make up your mind, I am going to accomplish whatever my goal is, and you have to be at that fever pitch, at that boiling point, and you have to be able to hold that boiling point, because only then will you be able to, in fact, succeed. And this yesod, my friends, is a yesod for success in most any endeavor that you'll engage in. As you probably know, if you've lived long enough to study people, the main key to success is hard work. When you're younger, you have this sort of naive sense, the guys who get the lucky breaks, yeah, they're the real, he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. But when you study the world, when you study people, when you study successful people, the one common denominator that you find over and over and over is hard work. Hard, consistent, persistent work, getting back in the game, getting back in the game again, getting back in the game another time. And the general rule in competitive sports, the general rule in the world of business, the general rule in the world of academics is that talent will get you only so far. The winning, the victory usually goes to the one who prepares more. The victory goes to the one who works harder. That's the usual rule of life. However, to do that, you need desire, you need commitment, and you need a persistency. But that persistency means you got to be at the boiling point and learn to hold the boiling point. And to hold the boiling point, what you really need is something called inspiration. And for many years now, I've been a big fan of inspirational material, whether it be autobiographies by great people, Jewish, secular. Doesn't matter to me, because if you watch a person who's accomplished something, you can learn from them, whether it be inspirational stories, even inspirational speakers. I think it's a very big part of successful people's lives to learn to find inspiration. However, there are two major weaknesses with inspirational material, inspirational seminars, autobiographies. This whole concept called inspiration has two major weaknesses to it. The first is that you need chizik in your inspiration. You see, inspiration comes and inspiration goes. You get excited and then leaves. You go to a seminar, you read a book, you have a life event, and you get really, really excited. That's it, I'm buying the treadmill, that's it, I'm doing it. And you're really inspired. But the inspiration weakens. I have a masorah, I have a Kabbalah for my Rebbe to learn Musar 20 minutes every day. And for much of my adult life, from the time I became a ben das, I kept that. There were short periods when I have to admit that I didn't. And I remember very vividly one time period when I didn't learn Musar on a daily basis. Now, I want you to keep in mind, I was a Rebbe in yeshiva. I was learning many, many hours a day, preparing for shir, giving shir. I was very, very involved. I was even giving Musar shmuzim. But for whatever which reason, I was not keeping a daily Seder in Musar at that point. And when I look back on that time period, I recognize that I made my most grievous errors. I made the most dumb mistakes. And the real reason was really quite simple. That boiling point, that inspiration, understanding what life was about and really feeling it was somehow lacking. And if you don't have a very vivid understanding that I'm here for a few short years, this world is passing, I have a mission, I have a goal, if that understanding sort of weakens a bit, you make different types of decisions. And I look back at that time period and I recognize that the inspiration that I had, that I sort of allowed to lack because I wasn't constantly re-inspiring it, allowed me to create, to make some bad decisions. And as a result of that, I regret and have since begun again on a regular basis learning Musa. Now, I say this next part with all its due meaning. I've had from time to time people say to me, you know, the Shmooze is good, I like it, but to be honest with you, it's getting boring. All right, granted, it's about growing and changing. You know, one week about it'll be about anger, next week about humility, one week it'll be about debt, you know, next week it'll be about marriage, one week it'll be about, you know, evolution, and granted you bring all kinds of stuff from science, and stuff from history, and observations of life, but at the end of the day, it's all about the same stuff. It's about growing and changing and getting inspired. It's like, it's getting boring. Why don't we do something else? And I've had guys say it to me almost bizarre lashon. Now, I have a daughter who is very skilled at Chinese jump rope. And I've considered, instead of doing a Musa Shmooze, giving a seminar in Chinese jump rope. You know, we could do highsies and lowsies, using elastic jump ropes as opposed to regular. We could do that, because the fella has a legitimate claim. All that we do is talk about things like growth, change, understanding why I'm here, understanding my future, understanding my relationships with others, understanding the effects of my work. It's all the same stuff. So after a while, it gets boring. But you got to hear the words. You see, on the one hand, the person is right. But that's exactly the point. You see, if something got you to the boiling point, it's not sufficient for you to get to the boiling point. What you have to know is how to hold that. And what that means is, when you sit down once upon a time to a Mesillas Yesharim, and it moves you, and it excites you, and you reach that fever pitch, you get it, I understand what I'm doing on this planet, and I'm a different person, that's very impressive. But if you can't go back to that moment, if you can't get re-inspired, that inspiration leaves you, and you're back to where you started, and you're not much different than you were before. And one of the great tricks in life is not just learning how to get to the boiling point, learning how to get to the boiling point and hold it. And learning, if it's a Musa Shmooze, learning to come to the Musa Shmooze, even if the first moment of excitement isn't there. It is true, like anything new, the first few times, the first 6 weeks, 6 months, whatever that window of time is, it's exciting, it's new, it's fresh, and it loses some of that. But that's exactly the point. When it loses some of that, that's when it's difficult, more difficult, to hold the boiling point, and to force yourself to come anyway, and to force yourself to get into it, and whether it be learning Musar, whether it be attending a Musar Shmuz, learning not just to reach the boiling point, but to learn to hold it and maintain it, is something that requires regular chizik. Now, my friends, don't think that it's in our world only. This concept is understood by people who excel in almost every endeavor. When I travel, I sleep exclusively in motels like Motel 6, maybe the Red Roof Inn. Who's ever running the $39.95 special that evening is my place. Not everybody has my impeccable taste and choice of establishments. Other people tend to spend more money and stay in different type of hotels. The Ritz-Carlton is one of them. Now, you're not going to get a Ritz-Carlton room for $39.95, but it is a vastly different experience. But you have to understand the philosophy of Ritz-Carlton. They are not telling you that they have the finest property in North America or the globe. They're not telling you that their amenities, that their spa, that the thickness of the carpet is the best in the world. They're not even telling you that their food is the finest cuisine. Although all of that may be true, that's not the package they're selling you. The package they're selling you is, when you walk in, you will feel like a king or you will feel like a queen, because we are at your service. And there are 25,000 employees of Ritz-Carlton who live, eat, sleep, and drink that to the extent that it's a consistent product. Their service is impeccable, and they've been studied, they've been analyzed, they win award after award, because the service that they provide is absolutely world class. Now, you may wonder, how do they get their 25,000 employees to do that? We can't get teenage kids to be polite, and yet they're getting people to treat regular guests as if they're ladies and gentlemen, kings and queens. Well, the answer is they understand a bit about the human. The first part is a very rigorous examination. It's not really an employment process. They meet you, and they spend 2 days meeting you. And if you pass the very rigorous employment process, you begin a 21-day training program. A 21-day training program indoctrinates you into their mottos, their credos. It's a 20-point service concept, and it basically surrounds the concept of our job is to serve, our job is to provide service, our job is to make our customer feel welcome. But this is where Ritz-Carlton really excels. It's after the 21 days when every employee takes their position, whether it's busboy, chef, maitre d', every single employee in Ritz-Carlton will spend the first 15 minutes of their day reviewing with the other employees one of those 20 principles. You see, they learn Musar B'Spilas 15 minutes a day with the other employees, and they discuss one of the principles, whatever the service principle is, how can we apply it, where can we do it, where did we do well yesterday, where can we do today, and it's part of the culture. It's a mandatory 15 minutes a day of Musar Seder, chazering, learning again. But wait a minute, you're a mature person. You learned that yesterday. You've been working at Ritz-Carlton for 10 years. You know all this stuff. What are you saying it again and reviewing it and reviewing it? What are you... But the answer is, what Ritz-Carlton understands is that theoretically knowing something and having it right here is a world of difference. It's a difference between 211 and 212. And when you hit the boiling point, but you don't hit it once, you know how to maintain it, you know how to hold it, then you are a very, very successful person. And that is a tremendous, tremendous concept. So if you'd like to know the first problem with inspiration, the first problem is that it comes and goes. It's not enough to know how to hit the boiling point. You got to know how to keep that inspiration. You got to know how to keep it at that boiling point. And one of the weaknesses of inspiration is you get inspired, but you have to learn how to keep it. But I believe that there's a second weakness in inspiration, and it's really rather, rather powerful. And I'll share with you what I mean. Does anybody know what the times for the 200-meter freestyle swim in the 1968 Olympics was? Anybody know offhand? 1968 Summer Olympics. What was the time for the 200-meter men's swim? Not a lot of people know. Okay, who won the Heisman Trophy in 1995? Okay, what about the last Nobel Prize in Science? Anybody know that one? How about, who was the richest guy in Poland in the 1850s? Anybody know that one? You see, the facts, the victory, the glory, the gold, even money, doesn't really matter, and people don't even remember it a year after it's done. Can you tell me the richest guy in Europe? You can only tell me the richest guy in America because you read Forbes yesterday. But believe me, you will not be able to tell me the richest guy in Scandinavia, nor the richest guy in New York, but it's his life, and he's striving, and he's reaching it, and he reached that level, he's the richest guy in New York. So who cares? You see, who cares? Because it really doesn't matter. And even for a minute, if it mattered because he won the gold medal, he won the absolute level of perfection, he reached the gold, and he won the 800-meter race, it doesn't matter to very many people. And even if you tell me it matters to him, I guarantee you, by the time he's 50, nobody cares. By the time he's 60, his grandchildren are sick and tired. Oh, there goes Grandpa again with the war story. I know Grandpa's hot in Mexico, and you were running. We heard it already. It's boring. But you see, nobody cares. Your grand success, your huge accomplishment, you reached the absolute pinnacle. Nobody cares. And the truth be told, even you don't care. And that, my friends, is a rather disheartening concept. If you're a goal setter, if you're a person who has dreams and aspirations, and you quickly realize that in a very short time, reaching the goal is forgotten, can quickly demotivate you. And I'd like to sort of deal with this second problem of inspiration by answering the second question. The second question that we asked was that Aharon HaKohen was quite happy. The Yalkut says that he known that Hashem would say about him that he saw Moshe Rabbeinu, and he was happy in his heart, then he would have come out with tupim umacholos, with tambourines and trumpets and tambourines. The problem is he was quite happy. So if he was quite happy, what does the Yalkut mean? And I'd like to address that question, and I'd like to see, by answering that question, if we could also understand a little bit better what goals are really about. A very quick observation. It is a very different experience when you cut a salami than when you cut a diamond. A salami, you kind of cut like whatever, and a diamond, you cut very, very cautiously, very, very carefully. If you'd like to know quite how carefully, I'll share with you something interesting. In 1990, in the district of Zaire, somewhere deep in the what was then the Republic of the Congo, a diamond was discovered. What was unusual about this diamond was that its raw weight was 777 carats. Quite a large rock. Now, it was purchased by De Beers, and they wanted to cut this diamond. But here was a problem. It was a clump. I mean, it was pretty big. And they brought in the best diamond cutters. They brought in the Steinmetz Diamond Group and a team, not a diamond cutter. You ever think of this old guy sits there with the chill? A team studied the rock. Would you like to know how long the team worked on it? They actually, when it came time to cut it, it wasn't done with chisels. It was done with lasers. The team spent 3 years studying the rock. And after 3 years of careful study, deliberations, calculations, they actually executed the cut. And from this came the famous De Beers Millennium Star, which is a 200-carat diamond. And it's considered the world's largest internally and externally flawless pear-shaped diamond. Okay, its value, by the way, is $500,000 a carat. And do the math at somewhere 203 carats. It's a pretty valuable rock. But you see, my friends, let's assume the team, instead of studying for 3 years, studied it for 2.5. And when they did the cut, they were mostly right, but a little off. The Millennium Diamond would not have been. As a matter of fact, it would have shattered into a bunch of small, little, insignificant diamonds. And this unbelievable now Millennium rock that the bear runs around showing off as the ultimate flawless diamond never would have been. You see, when you're cutting salami, if you cut a little bit wide, a little bit shallow, it really doesn't matter. But when you're cutting diamonds, it's such an exact science that a hair breadth, a fraction of a hair breadth, makes a difference between a perfect, beautiful, finished product or something that's almost worthless. And I believe that that has a lot of relevance to our discussion this evening. And I'll share with you what I mean. The pasuk that says, "Umsarechat lo tisalim," do not overlook your flesh. When it comes to tzedakah, do not overlook your flesh. The Yalkut Shimon is bothered by it. What do you mean, don't overlook your flesh? Don't overlook your friend, your reya, your neighbor. What do you mean, give tzedakah to your flesh? Give it to your friend, you mean to say. The pasuk is using the wrong expression. Says the Yalkut Shimon, no, this is actually Tani de Bar Kafra. Ein lecha adam she'ein balimida zu. There is no person who doesn't come to this midah. There is no person who does not experience poverty. Whether it be he, if it doesn't come to him, it'll come to his son. If it doesn't come to his son, it'll come to his grandson. Mibsarecha lo tisalim means don't overlook poverty because it's going to happen to you one day. When the ani comes to you, keep in mind one thing. Right now, Baruch Hashem, you have. Right now, Baruch Hashem, you're in a position of the usher giving. Very shortly, it will happen to you. You'll reverse positions, and if it's not you, it'll be your son. If it's not your son, it'll be your grandson. If you study just a tad of human history, what you find is that wealth comes and wealth goes. If you find the richest families from 200 years ago, what you find is the children enjoy the wealth. Sometimes the grandchildren, 3-4 generations, it's gone. And great wealth, and I mean extraordinary wealth, is gone within 2, 3, 4 generations, dissipates. And the Chofetz Chaim explains that that's a very important point. He says, kaviyochel, there could be Hashem had a problem. And that is, when Hashem created Adam, Hashem put us on the world to give us the opportunity to earn our schar, which was to last for eternity. But you see, eternity is a long time. A lot longer than 3 generations, a lot longer than 4 generations. Eternity is forever. But forever is so beyond the human conception, the human imagination. It stretches on and on and on and on and goes even beyond that. Says the Chofetz Chaim, Kaviyochel, there could be Hashem had a problem. How could man earn schar, reward that would last for eternity? The greatest wealth, the greatest riches in this world last for a generation, two generations, three generations. But how could you earn reward that will last for eternity? Explains the Chofetz Chaim that when Hashem put us in this world, Hashem put us in a position that we can exceed our bounds beyond anything that a human should be able to do. We were born into these giant, huge cranes. We were put into this position where my little, tiny me, I can do actions, say words that affect worlds, that change things, that make huge, huge effects. I don't perceive it. I don't understand it. But Hashem created worlds dependent on us. Hashem made the world itself, the physical world, dependent upon us. The upper worlds dependent upon us. Because Hashem wanted to give us the opportunity to create schar that would last for eternity. The reason why we never get it in terms of the severity, the gravity of an action, is because we think in very physical terms. How much could something be worth? $1, $10, $1,000, $10,000. But when you read the way Chazal depict a single action, the way they define a single dibur, you understand you're dealing with a very different currency. The currency you're dealing with is diamonds. And when you're dealing with a very precious diamond, a small nuance of change spells the difference between the millennium 203 almost perfect diamond to something that's almost worthless. A subtle difference, a hairbreadth of a difference makes a difference because the currency is vastly different. The crane is huge and it's having a huge effect. And that, my friends, I believe is the answer to Aaron HaKohen. There is no question that when Aaron went out to meet his brother, he accomplished a great thing. Despite the fact that he used to be the Navi, his brother was a Navi, he felt no jealousy, it was tremendous. And he reached 211 degrees. What a tzaddik. Because of it, he was zocha to the Choshen Mishpat. What a great man. But you see, 211 degrees is not quite 212. And in this world, it doesn't usually matter. But when you're dealing with schar for eternity, when your currency is diamonds, the way you cut the diamond, a tiny, subtle difference makes all the difference. And if you're not 212, if you're 211, it's a different world. And what the Yalkut is saying, had he known that Hashem was going to say that he walked out the simcha, it would have been a different simcha. You'll say he was happy anyway. How much of a difference does that difference make? The answer is that difference is huge because you're dealing with an action that's to last for eternity. You're dealing with diamonds that are so precious. And because of that, that difference made such a vast difference. My friends, these concepts are very, very powerful. I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn from Reuven. Reuven was very motivated to save his brother's life. He knew that it was murder. He knew that they were murdering Yosef HaTzadik, but he was only excited. He was at the level of 211. And because of that, he failed in his mission. He said, let's put him in the bar. He didn't actually save Yosef. Had he had another level of motivation, had he had another little level of drive, he would have picked Yosef up, brought him on the shoulders. It would have been a vastly different history. Yosef would not have been in Mitzrayim. That entire event wouldn't have happened. The difference between 211 and 212 shows itself in dramatic consequences, in dramatic manifestations, because when a human being hits that boiling point, he's unstoppable. But short of that, he is very, very stoppable. To maintain that requires something called inspiration. But inspiration comes, inspiration goes. It's not enough to hit the boiling point. You have to train yourself to hit it, to maintain it. You have to learn what gets you excited. You have to train yourself to go back to things that get you excited, maintain it, find new things, because maintaining that boiling point is one of the keys to success. But that is a key to success in this world. If you want to make money, if you want to win the Olympics, if you want to live a successful life, you have to be motivated, you have to be fever-pitched, you have to be at 212 degrees. But if you want to really succeed in life, if you want to succeed for eternity, you need the fever pitch for a wholly different reason. And that is because the difference that a subtle difference makes is huge when you're dealing with things that last for eternity. When Aaron HaKohen went out to meet his brother, he was very, very hot. He met his brother with simcha b'leiv. It was an almost perfect act. And in this world, the difference between an almost perfect act and a perfect act isn't that great. But when you're dealing with reward for eternity, when your currency is fine, fine diamonds, when it's a 777-carat rock that you're cutting, the difference between the exact right cut and the slightly off cut is huge. And that, I believe, is exactly what happened with Aaron HaKohen, and that is what the Yalkut is teaching us. And ultimately, the Yalkut also gives us the final lesson. And that final lesson is, what is the ultimate inspiration? Okay, I get it. I want to succeed, whether it be in this world, it'll be in the world to come, but how do I keep inspired? So the Yalkut tells us in its conclusion, it's one simple understanding. Every word that I say, every action that I take, is being recorded. Who's writing it down? Eliyahu HaNavi, the Melech, and the Melech HaMashiach, are writing them down, signed by Hashem. It's being videotaped, it's being recorded, it will be there for eternity. Every time I say, what's the big deal? Davening mincha, with a minyan, without a minyan, with kavana, without kavana, doesn't really matter. Seder had a mishnayos, I have to keep it every single day. I'll miss today, it's not the biggest deal in the world. Does it really, really make a difference? But when you understand this very simple concept, I'm being videotaped. For eternity, this moment is being recorded. And I will be weighed and measured, it will be dissected. Says the Yalkut, that's the most motivating force that a human being could tap into. If I could think about it, if I could understand it, my actions, my discussions, how I speak to people, how I act with people, how I act with my wife, how I act with my children, how I act with my boss, how I act with my employees is being recorded and being permanently part of the record. Says the Yalkut, that's one of the most motivating and powerful forces in the world, because when a person understands that, they begin to understand a vastly different perception. Let me close with a story that I think encapsulates this very concept. It was the end of World War I, and the Jewish conscripts in the Russian army were still eating tray food. Keep in mind, you went into the Russian army and you were told what to eat. It was onus, they were putter, but the reality is that many, many vast amounts of Jews were in the army eating tray food. The Chafetz Chaim, as an older man at the time, decided that he had to do something about it. He decided he was going to open up a kessel kosher, he was going to open up a kosher kitchen to organize the townspeople in the various towns to get kosher food to the soldiers, the Jewish soldiers who were there. Now, the Chafetz Chaim was an old man, recognized the need, but he really didn't have the power to do this alone. So he made the very difficult journey from Radin to Vilna to visit with none other than Rav Chaim Ozer. When the Chafetz Chaim walked in, needless to say, Rav Chaim Ozer stopped whatever business that he was involved in. The great Chafetz Chaim came, and the two met. And after a few moments of exchange, Rav Chaim Ozer asked the Chafetz Chaim, what brings the Rosh Yeshiva here? What brings the Rebbe here? And the Chafetz Chaim explained, we have these Jewish people. Granted, it's honest, but they're eating treif. We have to do something about it. Rav Chaim Ozer goes, yeah, absolutely. The Chafetz Chaim says, my plan is I'd like to start a kessel kosher, a kosher kitchen. We'll get the various townspeople to donate the food. All we need is the organizational structure. We have to set it up. And Rav Chaim Ozer goes, you're right. It's a tremendous idea, but it's not going to work. Chafetz Chaim goes, what do you mean? Rav Chaim Ozer goes, listen, it's World War I. The businesses, all the Jewish businesses were destroyed. They were looted. There's nothing left. The Jews were either evicted. There's no Ashiris left. There's no money. I can't, nobody we could tap into. It's just not going to work. And after Rav Chaim Ozer really convinced the Chafetz Chaim that it wouldn't work, the Chafetz Chaim began smiling, and he was so happy. He was filled with simcha. Rav Chaim Ozer looked at him and said, maybe the Chafetz Chaim didn't understand what I mean. I feel it. It's not going to work. And the more he would tell the Chafetz Chaim it wouldn't work, the happier the Chafetz Chaim was. And finally, Rav Chaim Ozer said, Shuldik, I have to ask respectfully, why is the Rebbe so happy when I've said that I don't think it's going to work? Chafetz Chaim says, don't you understand? I'm an old man. I don't have much time left in this world. I'm going to stand in front of my Creator, and He's going to ask me, why didn't I organize a kosher kitchen? And I'll say to Him, I was not lazy. As an old man, I made the very difficult trip from Radin to Vilna. I went to the Gadol HaDor himself. I went to Rav Chaim Ozer. Rav Chaim Ozer told me it can't be done, so I'm putter. Once I know that, I'll be able to answer to Hashem that I'm putter. Now I don't have to worry about it. At that point, Rav Chaim Ozer stopped and said, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Give me a few days. Needless to say, the kosher kessel began. Rav Chaim Ozer organized the Ashirim. He organized this infrastructure. And that project took hold. And there was only one change. Rav Chaim Ozer understood very well the gravity of Jewish people eating treif. He understood the gravity of his responsibility as the manhig ador. But it was a Chofetz Chaim's simple observation that, good, I'll be able to say to Hashem that I brought it to Rav Chaim Ozer. And Rav Chaim Ozer said, it's impossible. Those words hit him to the core, took him from 211 to 212, brought him to the boiling point, and all of a sudden what was impossible became possible. And my friends, that is a huge yesod for success in life. Getting almost there, being almost committed, being almost there is very nice, it's very good. But if you don't quite hit the boiling point, if you don't quite hit 212, you'll never reach greatness. But when you get to 212, the real secret is learning to maintain it, learning to keep it, learning to be there. May Hashem grant us the capacity, the ability, and the wisdom to put this into practice.
You've been listening to The Shmooze, presented by Teferis B'nai Torah. For more information on The Shmooze, please visit us at www.theshmooze.com, where you can download all the Shmoozing free of charge, as well as view source sheets and address questions or comments on this or any other Shmooze. The Shmooze is completely funded by private donations. We need your help to continue our work. All donations are tax deductible and count as miser. Please help us help others by calling 866-613-TORAH. That's 866-613-TORAH. Or you can make your donation right on the web at www.theshmooze.com.